Okay.
Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening and welcome, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, the extended edition. And that song that you've been listening to and that I've teased you with is Nomad's Land by Zingaya. Well, we're officially in the widely anticipated series called Four Mothers and Wayshowers, which will go until February now, with guests and their work in the world all top-notch. And what an honor it is to be creating this wonderful archive of their voices and vision as they're interviewed each Wednesday night on the show. Our latest addition to the lineup of noted guests is feminist Phyllis Chesler, known for her many books and her activism. My favorite book of hers is Women's Inhumanity to Women. I've also booked Ava Park, the visionary foundress of one of the only brick-and-mortar goddess temples on Mother Earth right here in Southern California at the Goddess Temple in Orange County. And thank you, listeners, for emailing me your appreciation for the effort that went into making this series happen. You know, that's just like gas in my tank. And don't be fooled. This isn't work for me. I'm having a wonderful time following my bliss, chatting with these awesome women and fellas. And thanks to all the foremothers and wayshowers themselves for taking the time to let their fans and students know they're out there doing their work. We all appreciate their time to give us an update on what's their current burning passion and their beliefs during this important junction for women in our time. You won't want to miss it, so be here every Wednesday night at 6 or listen from the archives at your own convenience. Tonight our guest is Lane Redman. Besides an author of the beloved book When the Drummers Were Women, she's an award-winning percussionist, and she's credited with awakening women's spiritual connection to the drum. In November, guests will also include Starhawk, Barbara Walker, and Joan Marler, who continues the work of gender archaeologist Maria Gimbutas. Guests throughout the series include, but aren't limited to, Rhianne Eisler, Carol Chris, Charlene Spretnak, Eleanor Gadden, Jean Shinoda Bolin, and we have our local teacher here from UCLA, Miriam Robbins Dexter. Well, I've been asked how I chose the women and men being interviewed on the current series, Four Mothers and Wayshowers. Well, I got to tell you, it wasn't easy because there's so many dedicated and talented men and women who've contributed so much. It was much like when I had to choose which sacred sites to include in my book. Actually, omitting some sites felt like cutting off limbs. That's, you know, not much of an exaggeration. Also, too, when I chose the guests, I wanted to give a variety of people a platform for their work, particularly if there was someone I grew up knowing as a teacher or a mentor. I turned to my library, personal referrals, people who were visible out there in the world, people who were making a difference or had name recognition. And no doubt this still leaves out so many worthy people because the show only airs once a week. Well, I'm currently trying to book men on the show and people out there in the world making change. My latest guest booked, as I said earlier, is Phyllis Chesler, feminist activist and author of Women's Inhumanity to Women. So if you have any ideas for guests, please feel free to send them in. Now, if you're new to Voices of the Sacred Feminine here on Blog Talk, we take your callers. So if you like, dial in, ask questions toward the end of the interview. The number is 718-766-4662. When I see your call on the switchboard, I'll identify you by your area code and welcome you to have a chance to ask our guest a question. Again, that number is 718-766-4662. And if you can't listen live or don't want to be on the air, you can always email me some of your questions in advance. But keep tuning in each Wednesday. Don't miss us. In fact, join Blog Talk as a listener. It's free. And have reminders sent to your email box of our shows so you won't forget about our awesome guest lineup each week. And please, if you're a fan of the show, indicate that by selecting us as a favorite on Blog Talk Radio. Well, now it's time for that opening segment you tell me you like so much called What's the Buzz? And let's see, a few announcements. According to Associated Press, the Muslim country of Kuwait has decided to begin granting women passports without spousal permission. Certainly a great stride for women's rights. Unlike Saudi Arabia, Kuwait women can vote, also serve in parliament, and drive. This decision by Kuwait's highest court ruling freed women from the 1962 law requiring their husband's signature to obtain a passport. They found that the law undermined women's free will and compromised women's humanity. Going from Kuwait to Turkey, archaeologists have found traces of a temple built for the Greek goddess of divine retribution. Her name was Nemesis. This was during excavations in the ancient city of Agora near the port city of Izmir. Lead archaeologist Akin Ersoy speculates there might have been a temple built for Nemesis in the area. The clues to the temple were found as the team was unearthing finds from the Ottoman era. Only problem is they think the temple is under a local high school, so yikes, that might be a little hard to excavate. But the city of Agora was constructed during the rule of Alexander the Great, and the area has also turned up statues of Poseidon and Demeter, which are on display in the Archaeological Museum in Izmir. In Greek mythology, Nemesis was the spirit of divine retribution against those who succumbed to hubris and vengeance. Some considered her a remorseless goddess who righted wrongs. Thanks to the Anatolia News Agency for announcing this new find. Jumping from Turkey to Vatican City in Rome, the news is the Vatican is seeking to lure disaffected Anglicans. They're trying to entice traditionalists opposed to women priests, gay clergy, and gay marriage into their ranks. The change means conservative Anglicans from around the world would be able to join the Catholic Church while retaining aspects of their Anglican liturgy and identity, including married priests. So if you're like me, a former Catholic, hoping perhaps the Catholic Church might get a bit more liberal as their congregations shrink, nope. This is how they hope to swell their ranks, not with progressive ideas, but with joining forces with conservative Anglicans. The decision also brought back under the Vatican wing four excommunicated bishops, one who denied the Holocaust. And finally, back on the North American continent, at the recent sold-out Peace Summit in Vancouver, His Holiness the Dalai Lama made a proclamation that stunned the crowd. This is his quote, "The world will be saved by the Western woman." That's a quote from the Dalai Lama. Well, how's that for a nice note to end the What's the Buzz segment? The bees are happily escaping my bonnet with that proclamation, and I hope one day soon to have the sound of bees for the opening and closing of this What's the Buzz segment each week. We'll see. And now, our guest tonight, Lane Redmond. Lane, are you still on the line there, patiently waiting?
Yes, I am.
Well, thank you so very much, and I know you had bad weather there in Florida, and it was a, you know, kind of an effort for you to be here tonight, so I'm sure, just like my listeners, I really appreciate you being here with us.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be able to be on your show, and when I heard the lineup that you've got, so many of those women were references. Their work and their books were references for When the Drummers Were Women, so it's, I'm honored to be in the company of the authors that you're interviewing. It's really an amazing job that you're doing.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much. And, and as I said in the opening, you know, it was really hard, you know, who to invite, who to leave out. Sometimes it came down to, you know, people just couldn't be found. Like, for instance, I would have loved to have gotten Merlin Stone on the show, but she, you know, there's no website. Some of the older ladies just are not, you know, on the computer, and you can't find them on the internet. I couldn't find her through phone records. records or anything like that. So listeners out there, if any of you know how to reach Merlin Stone, please let me know or let her know I'm looking for her. But, you know, it was sometimes very difficult to track down some of these foremothers. And I feel exactly like you. I grew up learning from them, and to talk to them is a great honor.
Yes, I think that I'd heard years ago that Merlin had really sort of withdrawn. She had really withdrawn into her own privacy, and that was quite a few years ago. So I haven't heard anything of her either. And but her book was certainly an important book for all of us. When God Was a Woman, I mean, obviously, look at the title of my book, When the Drummers Were Women. You know,
well,
I was very
Sorry, I didn't mean to step on your words there. Yeah, her book and Rhianne Eisler, Chalice and the Blade, those were the two books that got me started down this path. And, yeah, you know, but that explains why maybe I can't find her. Somebody told me that she lives in New York, but, you know, it's a big place, and I tried most of the area codes, and it was rather difficult. So any help out there from listeners would be greatly appreciated. It would be wonderful for all of us if she's willing to be on the show.
It would be
But let's you know, turn our focus to you, Lane, because I know lots of our listeners, you know, from the emails I've been getting, they're just anxious to hear from you. Tell me, how did you get started? You know, I mean, what put you on the path?
Well, you know, this is going to be pretty funny, but when I was about 14 or 15, I saw Karen Carpenter on television playing a drum set, and I thought that that was amazing, and I thought that's what I wanted to do. And I told my mom, and she said, "Oh, honey, stick with your tap dance lessons. You know, the drums are for boys." And we did live in a very rural area. It would have been rather challenging for me to have pursued learning to play the drum set anyway, but I did stick with my tap dance lessons, and I was also a cheerleader. And later, as I've become so involved in creating and participating in community rituals, I realized that my training as a cheerleader was really, in terms of community ritual, that was the most important community ritual in Citrus County, the football game. And there I was rousing and shaping group energies through rhythmic chanting, clapping, and movement. So that was just the beginning of becoming, that was the beginning of my rhythmic training, the tap dancing and the cheerleading. And I went off to college, majored in art, and moved to New York City and was living the life of a starving artist. It was great fun in the early late 70s, early 80s. I was really involved in performance artwork. I was taking courses with Joseph Campbell at Hunter's College. I was studying a lot of mythology, seeing a lot of improvisatory, mythical performance work. I became very involved in yoga and Tibetan Buddhism. And the first time I went to a Tibetan Buddhist ritual, that just really changed everything for me, because a lot of the downtown performance art scene, the dance, the theatrical, and the performance art, it was sort of pseudo-ritual without any sort of spiritual underpinnings or structure behind it. And when I went to a Tibetan empowerment for the first time that included traditional Tibetan musicians and artists creating the sand mandalas and the whole meditation, it was, I thought, oh, something's actually happening here. And that was sort of the end of the whole performance art thing for me. And I pursued that. But I also started taking drum classes. I saw a poster for a drum class, and I registered. It was Afro-Cuban, and I was, of course, the teacher was a man, but all the students were women. And it was the first time that I really experienced that trance union with mostly other women. And the last class, the conga teacher brought in a man named Glenn Velez, and he had a Brazilian tambourine called a pandeiro with him. And he played the pandeiro, and the other teacher played the conga. And afterwards, he said, I'm moving to California, but Glenn lives here in New York, and he gives lessons. So I took Glenn's name. I was still, you know, really into the bigger drum, but I went to see Glenn give a concert, and he played all kinds of frame drums from all around the world, and it was pretty amazing. I'd never seen anything like it. And I talked him into giving me a lesson after the concert, but he also had played a dumbak, which is an hourglass-shaped drum from the Middle East, and it was somewhat more similar to the conga than the tambourines and other types of frame drums that he was playing. But when I showed up for that first lesson, he met me at the door, and he said, I have bad news. I've dropped my dumbak. It was ceramic, and it was broken. And he put a Middle Eastern tambourine in my hands, and he said, how about this? So without ever making a specific decision that I was going to learn to play the tambourine, there I was with my first frame drum in my hands. And for your listeners that don't know exactly what a frame drum is, it's a drum that the diameter of the head is much wider than the depth of the shell. The depth of the shell is usually only 2 to 3 to maybe 4 inches for the very largest frame drums that could be from Ireland, the Bowrons, are about 20, 22 inches wide. And there's a very small frame drum from South India called the Kanjira, and it's only about 4 inches wide and about an inch and a half deep, two to three inches deep. All the tambourines with skin heads are frame drums. So frame drums, tambourines are all frame drums, but not all frame drums have jingles on them. And one thing that I began to realize after many years of studying the history of the frame drum is that the jingles came from the sistrum, another very ancient instrument.
So, can I ask you a question about the sistrum?
Sure.
Just real quick, I didn't expect to talk about that, but since it came up, I'll take advantage of this opening here. You know, the sistrum is something that I've really been interested in because of my Isis connections, and
exactly.
I read, you know, during the course of, you know, how they made the sistrums, how they used the sistrums, that they actually perhaps tune them rather than them all having jingles on them. Is that something you have heard or know about or can talk a little bit about, the tuning of the sistrum rather than the jingles?
No, I haven't. And I have written a scholarly paper on ancient Egyptian percussion and read all of the ethnomusicologists' work on that. So I have not heard anything about that. The thing about jingles, it depends on the thickness of the jingle and the diameter, the size of the jingle, and how many jingles are being used in terms of the overall pitch and the sound. And then in Egypt, there were two different types of sistrum. One was made out of faience, it was ceramic, and one was made out of metal. So the sounds of those two sistrums would have been very different because the metal jingles were going to be rattling against metal or sliding back and forth against metal or against ceramic. So that would have been quite different. So I'm not sure. I have not come across any information about the tuning, but I'm not sure that we're using the terms in the same way. If you want
okay.
to explain a little further, maybe I can help you.
Well, you know, quite honestly, I'm not really a musician, so I don't really know. I just, you know, read from another Isis priestess, and I've sort of perpetuated the idea sometimes. You know, she actually said that sometimes the tuning rods were tuned to specific notes, and I don't remember offhand right now what the notes were. I have that written in my research someplace, but I found it a little hard to comprehend, quite frankly, that the horizontal rods could actually somehow be tuned, or the jingles could be tuned to particular notes. And, it was just one of those mysteries. I wondered if maybe there was some translation that we were misinterpreting or something like that.
Well, in all my research, I have not seen anything like that in the scholarly world. Maybe this is not coming out of the scholarly world. Every jingle certainly has a pitch to it, and the jingles are extremely important. That for me is extremely important. And you really get into collecting many different types of jingles. And not only jingles are used on frame drums, but the drum that I'm really interested in learning right now is from Iran, and it has many different names, but one name is Dara, or Da for Dara, and it has little chains that are only about a quarter of an inch in wide, the actual links, and then there'll be about four or five links, and they're attached to the inside of the frame drum, so the chain hangs down and then bounces on the head and makes a beautiful sound. And then there are other types of doras and gavals from Azerbaijan that have bigger rings. The rings can be up to an inch, or they can be smaller, and they fit through like a round eye hook, and those also jingle. And, oh my God, there's just many, many different types of jingles, and the jingles themselves, it depends on the style of the playing. Like the jingles from the Middle Eastern tambourines from Egypt and Syria are made of brass, the professional ones. They're quite heavy. They're very different from the jingles on the traditional tambourines from Italy or Sicily. And some of those are made out of, canned lids, like catfish can lids, hammered out. And they have a completely other effect. But ring metal has a profoundly trance-inducing effect on the mind. And I work a lot with metals in different forms, obviously with jingles on the drums, but I also work with Tibetan bowls and Tibetan bells and gongs. That's something I'm working on very intensely right now. So ringing metal has, from the earliest records, been used to dispel negative energies and create a sacred space and invite in or invoke the sacred. The drum itself is often described as having the same powers. The frame drum, which is the world's oldest known drum, it's used to dispel and banish negative energies and bring in the divine. It invokes the sacred presence. So when those two instruments, which were probably played separately for several thousand years at least, if not longer, were combined to make a tambourine, then you had an extremely powerful sacred object. And I believe the frame drum is the oldest technology that we have for transforming states of mind for spiritual or religious or ritual purposes. It's in all the pre-Christian Mediterranean traditions, and it's in the Old Testament as the timbrel and the tosh. Don't forget Miriam's tambourine, which that's a translation of timbrel or tosh, and her drum probably did not have jingles, so tambourine is probably an inaccurate term for her drum. So, I could spend an hour talking to you about jingles. So we probably let me get to the point where I found out that the drum was connected to the ancient goddesses, because I think that's a really, that's sort of the key thing that happened to me. I started taking these lessons with Glenn, not knowing anything about the history of the drum. And he had started collecting images of the ancient frame drums from the Mediterranean world. And I had majored in art. I was a photographer. And I realized he hadn't duplicated the slide collection. I got involved in helping duplicate it, organize it. And I realized that almost all the images of the drummers, frame drummers, from the ancient Mediterranean world were women. And I thought,
Now, Lane, let me ask you about that. Was that pretty much known? I mean, as people looked at these artifacts, were they identifying these round discs that, you know, the priestesses or the goddesses were holding? Were they identifying them as drums, or were they thinking they were maybe something else?
Well, you sound like you know what some of the archaeologists have called them. mostly they have been identified as drums by most archaeologists, but there are some that called these women with capes.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, and there's some people still calling goddesses ancient Barbie dolls too, so.
Yes, exactly, but that today is pretty much, you know, that's pretty much disproved. I mean, it's just so obvious that most of them are drums. It's just very, very obvious. There is a style from Iran and Iraq, which was ancient Sumer and Mesopotamia, in which they're holding them in the front, and those are the disputed ones. But I have many images of traditional players from over 100 years ago, from as long ago as 1865, of traditional male players holding these drums in these same positions that the archaeologists are calling, well, what I call cake position. So it's fairly well recognized. But at the time that I started looking at this, there were several scholarly papers written, and one woman had written about of drums and damsels. Or of damsels and drums. I remember I was quite put off by calling them damsels. You know, there have been a few articles written about these ancient frame drummers, and that most of them were women, but no one had put the history together. And I began, well, first of all, I had to figure out who were these women that were holding the drums. So I had to study the inscriptions on the sculptures or on the vases. There's many, many depictions of the Greek and Roman priestesses playing the frame drums on vases. In Egypt, many depictions are inscribed on temple walls. That's really where we see them in Egypt. From ancient Sumer and Mesopotamia, small sculptures that were placed in home shrines or in burial remains. The frame drum was used in the burial rites of every culture in the Mediterranean world. And so people were buried with small sculptures of women drummers, or on the outside of their tombs were engravings of women playing the frame drum. Or they were buried with their drums, their actual drums. And we had the oldest frame drums that have survived have come from the tombs in Egypt. There's three or four. There's one large rectangular frame drum. There are rectangular and square frame drums also. And that was found in the tomb of a woman named Hatnefer. So anyway, I began the process of studying these drums and then found out that most of the images were of different goddesses, like Aphrodite, Inanna, Isis, Hathor, Cybele, many goddesses. So I didn't know about them particularly. I didn't know about their traditions. So I had to start studying their traditions and their cultures and understand why they were being depicted with drums. Why were these goddesses being depicted with drums? And why were so many of the priestesses of these goddesses depicted with drums? And I want to make it very clear that this is, or was, the predominant drum in the ancient Mediterranean world. And it was played predominantly by women. I would go as far as to say, out of the thousands of images that I have collected throughout my travels through Greece, through Turkey, Cyprus, Syria, Egypt, through the museums in Europe, because so much of the Middle Eastern art has been taken by Europe and also in the United States. And through my research in archaeological magazines, at least 90% of the images are of women. And that's very conservative. It's probably more like 98%. The place where you actually see more, I've found maybe three images of male frame drummers from ancient Egypt, one from ancient Iran, two or three from ancient Assyria, which is now Iraq, and I probably have 30 or so from ancient Greece. So there's many more from ancient Greece than anywhere else. I have thousands of depictions of women playing this drum. So it was the primary drum. It was played primarily by women. So I also wanted to find out what happened. You know, why did it switch? Because at my experience at that point in my life was in the early 80s, there were almost no women percussionists, or the women percussionists that were around really had to struggle to make it as percussionists at that time. And
what shifted the balance in power? Was it I know in some ancient cultures, when I was researching my book, like in South America, for instance, a lot of the history is not definitive, but it was suggested that the women used to be the holders of the music, the bearers of the instruments. But then something shifted, and the power of the males sort of dominated the women. Part of it was taking away the music. Part of it was taking away the instruments. Is it something to do with that?
Well, like I said, I can talk for hours on this subject, but what I'll say here is that by studying the images painted on the drums themselves, and the colors that the drums were painted, often red, the color of blood, and the symbols painted, lotuses, the bindu, the omphalos symbol. Without being able to show these images to your reader, I'm just going to just jump ahead and say that what I found in my research is that the drums represented the first sound that we hear in the womb, which is the sound of our mother's blood pulsing through her arteries. It's not the heartbeat. So it's the pulse of blood. And this is the first sound that we hear. And so it has an incredibly powerful effect. I mean, we take form to this sound. And drumming, I believe that all drumming is an echo of this first sound. And the frame drum was used in all the ancient mystery schools, all the ancient death and rebirth rites of Demeter and Persephone. Persephone is recalled from the underworld by the sound of frame drums and gongs and bull roars, the trance that's created in the rituals of Dionysius and Ariadne, Aphrodite, Adonis, Cybele, Attis, Isis, Osiris, Hathor, and Horus is the frame drum. That's what creates this trance in which people have a symbolic death and then they are drawn back into a rebirth, into a new state of being. The drum has the power to draw you back to this original state of consciousness that you take form with, this unconditioned state of awareness before you enter into the family trance or into the trance of social conditioning. So that, I believe, first of all, it's an echo of the sound of the mother's blood, and these goddesses are creatress goddesses. They are the creator of the universe. One strike on their drum and everything vibrates into existence. What happened? What turned this away? Because right from the earliest times, you see ensembles of musicians that are men and women. So it wasn't that women had sole control over the music. I would never go so far as to say that. But the frame drum in particular was the tool of the priestesses of these different goddesses. And with the rise of the newer religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, women could no longer hold the spiritual office of priestess. And the drum was so heavily associated with women in roles of spiritual authority that the drum was banned, particularly in Christianity. Not so much, and it was also lost in Judaism. It's coming back now. But the drum itself was not completely lost, and definitely in the Middle Eastern traditions it wasn't lost. But the main source that I used to track the decrees against women playing the drums and playing music is I'm not going to think of the exact title, but it's a book put out by the Catholic Pastoral Musicians Association on the history of pagan and early Christian music. And the book is just full of decrees. You know, they're tracing the history of the early church against women playing the frame drum. So that's where the drum is taken out of women's hands. There's decree after decree for hundreds of years. So you can see it wasn't really effective for a long time. I mean, they had to, and in the end, they never succeeded in getting the drum completely away from women in Italy and in Portugal. In Greece, it pretty much disappeared, but in Italy and Portugal and Spain, it's still, I mean, until recently, where we've seen this completely renaissance flowering of the frame drum traditions, it was only the older people that were still playing in the traditions and the folk traditions in the villages, and it was mostly just older women.
Any speculation on why it survived in those particular countries but not Greece?
Oh, now, I haven't thought about that too much, but Roland Storm, who started playing the frame drum back when I did, if not a little bit earlier, left New York City over 20 years ago and moved to Athens and has lived in Greece and studied Turkish and Iranian. And she just flew into Iran last week and was turned away. After she landed, she was put back out of the country because she went in last year and went all the way into the Kurdish part of Iran because that's where the women are still playing the frame drums. She's just really been pushing the limits of trying to find where the women are still playing these rituals. And she pushed too many limits there, and they wouldn't let her back in this time. It's also
I'm really curious. Do you know on what grounds they turned her away? Was it just for her, women's rights? It was a women's rights issue?
When she goes there, she wears a burqa. I mean, she completely goes traditional to go there, and I mean she went by herself back into an area that Al-Qaeda still has a lot of influence, and that's probably why they turned her back this time, because she had gone against their wishes and gone into regions that are very dangerous, actually very dangerous. So I don't even think she was told why she couldn't come back in, but she's now back in Turkey. And she's the one that mentioned to me recently why there were no women left playing, that there's hardly any frame drum tradition left in Greece. Now, this is on her words. She's much more of an authority about this than I am. And she felt that was because of the strength of the Greek Orthodox Church.
Okay. I'm loving this conversation about the drum, but I want to make sure we also save time to talk about your other work. You're invoking Aphrodite, CD, the bee priestess work. What else do you want our listeners to know about the drum? And then we'll segue over into the other material. Does that sound good to you?
Sure. Well, I guess the one thing I would say about the drum is that it's an archetypal idea. Almost every culture comes up with the idea of a frame drum. It's a simple hoop, you know, a simple piece of wood soaked in water and then bent into a circle with the skin stretched over it. Anything from a goat has been used traditionally, calf, deer. But not deer in the Middle East too much, and fish skins, surgeon skins. And when you pick up the frame drum, I mean, I have found thousands of images of these women frame drummers, and that's after a concerted effort to destroy these images by the traditions that came afterwards. For thousands of years, women played these drums. And so I feel that when I pick up this drum, or when any woman does, we are picking up an archetype. And it has an archetypal power. When people see a woman playing the frame drum, this just clicks back through our DNA and hits off all these archetypal images in the mind. So I do want to take the one thing from these ancient priestesses and women and tie it into the present, which is that the name for many of these priestesses of the different goddesses in ancient Greek were the Melissas. And Melissa means bee in Greek and Latin. And in the ancient Hebrew, they were the Deborahs, which means bee or swarm of bees. So there was this tradition of bee priestesses that played the frame drum. And there's all these amazing connections in the ancient texts, between attracting bees with tambourines and the sounds of the drums, and just all these extremely interesting connections. And so I have pursued that as much as possible. And I've also, like I said, I had started studying yoga at 17, and I had received from my South Indian teacher a practice called Brahmari. Brahmari is Sanskrit for bee, and it's a pranayama. It's a rhythmic humming breathing practice. And it's really a buzzing practice. It actually, when done, of course, there's many different forms of Brahmari. They're all buzzing practices, but some of them, when done appropriately, really sound like the buzzing of bees. And it has effect on the mind. It's traditionally given to people who have too many thoughts, whose minds are too busy, who may have problem with insomnia. It's now being used in hospitals in India to help women relax and go through labor. It's traditionally said to be a practice of the heart chakra. And the heart chakra in the Sanskrit tradition is called Anahat. Anahat is the unstruck sound. But the texts say that the sound that we can actually hear that is the most similar to this unhearable sound that is behind all of reality, that creates all of reality, is the buzzing of the bees. So there's something mystical in the frequency of the bees, and I'm working towards setting up a situation with a neurosurgeon here in Florida, in Gainesville, that we could actually start to find out what is happening to the brain in terms of brain waves when you are listening to the sound of bees. So this is a big subject, and you know, I could go off in many different directions, but I had started two recording projects almost sort of simultaneously, and one was using ancient Greek texts. And about 4 years ago, a group of women in Cyprus read my book, When the Drummers Are Women, and Cyprus was one of the places where there was such a huge concentration of images of women frame drummers, probably more than any other one small place, because Cyprus is just a fairly small island. Of so many images, there are so many sculptures of frame drummers from around 1500 BC to 500 or 600 BC, and it was the birthplace of Aphrodite, one of the great bee goddesses. So then I began to realize that many of these goddesses connected to the frame drum were also considered bee goddesses. Cybele, Artemis, Demeter, Persephone, Neith from Egypt. I mean, it's just extremely interesting. So what is going on here? You know, I just find these connections and then try to pursue them. So the Cypriot women brought me there 4 years ago to teach them to play the frame drum. And they have continued. They bring in other great teachers. They have really reclaimed their tradition, and they are reclaiming their ritual traditions. based around the sacred feminine there. It's very, very profound what has happened. Very, very profound. And so they are chanting the text that I'm using for the CD invoking Aphrodite. They're chanting in the ancient Greek on these pieces. And the sound of ancient Greek is as powerful as the sound of Sanskrit. It's just, it's so incredible. So the title piece for this CD is by Sappho, her poem to Aphrodite, invoking Aphrodite. And so it opens with me, you know, saying that piece in English, and then they chant it in ancient Greek. But at the same time that I was working on that album, and I was working on text from the Pythia priestess at ancient Delphi, or people may be more familiar with saying it in English, it's Delphi, and two of the oldest surviving pieces of ancient music that were notated, the melodies, one, the Siculus Epitaph, written in 300 BC, we did a recording of that, and also the Hymns of the Muse by Messenides of Crete in the 2nd century AD. We did a recording of that. But at the same time, I had started working on this album called Hymns from the Hive, where I'm working with the actual recordings of the bees in their hives, around the hives, and that becomes the pitch center for all those pieces of music. And all at the same time, I'm having a lot of beekeepers show up in my drumming workshops. So one of them says, you have to come. I have 5,000 hives. 5,000 hives.
Wow.
She's my age. We're in our later 50s. And, you know, she was a part of that Back to the Earth in the early 70s. And the way she and her husband decided they were going to survive on a small farm was to become beekeepers. And now they work with many farmers in northern central Michigan, around Twin Lakes and Muskegon, who rely on their bees to pollinate their crops. And then she brings them down here to the Panhandle, she and her husband, to winter and make honey out of Tupelo here where I am. Her winter site is about 30 minutes from where I am right now in the Panhandle. So she said, you have to come while I'm grafting the new queens. And I did last February and spent a lot of time looking into the hives and looking at the queens and looking at the larvae and, oh, my God, watching bees come out of their little honeycombs for the first time, chewing their way out. I mean, it was sleeping. I went to sleep in the midst of these hives and the buzzing of all these hives. And lots of my students now have become beekeepers. So the last year and a half, I've had no set home in the United States, and I've been staying with people all around the country, and many people have bees now. So I spend a lot of time listening, watching, and now I'm understanding a lot of the ancient Greek mythology in terms of what I'm seeing in the hives. It's just been really profound. So the new CD that's not released yet, Hymns from the Hive, is like the other side of the coin for invoking Aphrodite with the ancient Greek text. So the poem by Sappho, written in the 7th century BCE, who was a, you know, I'm dumbfounded at how many people do not know about Sappho today, especially young people. That's very challenging to me. So that's one of my big goals right now, is to make sure that people know of her work. She was as well-known and possibly more beloved than Homer and Hesiod. And the Christian church definitively tried to destroy her work. The only reason we have so many fragments is because later great Greek scholars used so much of her work to illustrate brilliant points of the usage of the language. So she was a poet, she was a composer, she was a teacher, and she was a priestess of Aphrodite. And so this poem that I'll read right now, I realized was not only to invoke the presence of Aphrodite, but it was actually calling the bees.
Okay, let's hear it.
Leave Crete. Come here. Come to the holy place. Come to the sacred grove. Your altars are smoking with incense. Cold water sings through the fruited trees. Everything is shaded under the bower of roses. And from the shimmering radiance of leaves, an enchanted sleep drops down. Here is a meadow of spring flowers where horses graze and a soft wind gently breathes. Come, Aphrodite, pour your nectar into our golden cups. In grace, make the libation. Bring your Melissas to life. Mm. So I realized that she's really calling the bees, the swarm of bees. I did add that last line myself, bring your Melissas to life. But she's talking about the enchanted sleep, the larvae sleeping in their little golden cups. Come, Aphrodite, pour your nectar into our golden cups. In grace, make the libation. You know, fill the cups with honey. Put the royal jelly in for the queen. You know, I mean, it's just when I began to realize all this and that the reason that virgins wear white is because the queens who are growing in their special cones that the worker bees make for them are white until right before they chew their way out of their comb. They're completely white, but their eyes are magenta. Anyway, there's so many things. I know, there's just something so transformative to being around
bees. Well, you know, you make me think about, you know, talking about Aphrodite and the bees. If you've been to Turkey, you probably have seen that statue of Aphrodite from Aphrodisias. That's so different from the typical Botticelli Aphrodite. And she looks, you know, she has the registers on her torso. She looks more like Artemis and, you know, and a number of the animals that are actually depicted on her torso are bees. And there's just something about that statue of her seems so much more authentic. About, you know, who she really was and everything she embodied, you know, rather than just, you know, the classical Greek Aphrodite. And, and this just adds another layer.
No, she was really descended from Inanna and Ishtar, Ashtart. She was really an Asian goddess. She was a primordial, you know, creatress goddess. There's an amazing book. I don't know how your readers would get it here, but I dedicated the CD to Mrs. Jacqueline Cadiorier, who is the great scholar of Aphrodite on Cyprus. She is in her 80s now, and she wrote an amazing book called Kypris, the Aphrodite of Cyprus. And it's really, it's an astounding book. So I don't know how people can get it, but it's a profound book and shows how deep and how vast the history of Aphrodite was just on Cyprus. But Cyprus was a great pilgrimage place, and I believe the temple there was one of the seven wonders of the world. But people came on pilgrimage there. And we're actually trying to, with the help of the Cypriot Tourist Organization, because they're totally supporting us. It's so interesting because they're trying to promote Cyprus as the birthplace of Aphrodite. So we've actually been getting a fair amount of support from the Cypriot Tourist Organization, which is a part of the government there, the Ministry of Culture. And we are hoping to, you know, bring life back to this old concept of this festival every summer where people would come to honor Aphrodite. And maybe, you know, if they want to do it as a tourist festival, that's okay with us. As long as we get support and we bring drumming back and we bring these rituals back, that's what we're sort of really excited about.
Well, you know, I'm just naturally inclined to always think sacred pilgrimage, and I don't know whether you've ever done this, but as you're talking and I'm just enjoying hearing, you know, all of your revelations and aha moments, and I'm thinking how wonderful it would be to go on a tour with you to sacred sites, you know, playing drums at sacred sites and ritual. Have you ever done that before?
Yes, I've taken a group to Egypt and to Crete and to Cyprus and Greece, and there is one planned for, we're trying to get the date set in probably in mid-June, where I will go to Cyprus. I'll teach a beginner's workshop and an advanced workshop. We'll go to all the sacred sites of the Aphrodite, and there's an amazing polyphonic concert in Athens right around that time. That's where we're waiting for the dates, because we want to have that concert, which is amazing. This really sort of pre-Hellenic style of music, polyphonic singing that I was able to see this last June. And so, yes, I've done that many times, and I haven't done it in a number of years. I've been bringing people to Brazil, but this year I'm going to be taking people to Cyprus, and the women from Cyprus, the drummers, are very involved in this, and it is going to be based around drumming. Now, the thing about Cyprus is that the temples have really been destroyed, but the sacred spring of Aphrodite is still there, and the big rock of Aphrodite is still there, and the island is very powerful in and of itself. And right now, out of all this stuff, I have gotten very connected to Mary, you know, the Christian Mary, which, and of course all the Greek islands and Cyprus included, are just covered with chapels to Mary. And I had for years been planning to go to Crete. I was so excited about going, and I took a group when I went for the first time. And I thought the whole trip was, you know, for me, it was going to be focused around the ancient Minoan culture. But instead, I was just totally taken up by Mary. I mean, we did do the whole ancient Minoan thing, but actually the only time I've ever dreamed of a deity was on that trip. And Mary came and actually sang a song to me, and it was the Beatles song, Let It Be, Let It Be. And so I've actually have been plunged into working on this project. You know, I've been calling it the Blessed Mother Prayer Pack. I've been taking images of Mary all over the Greek world, all over Brazil, all over through the missions throughout California. And I'm going to be going to Italy also to teach a retreat in northern Italy right before I go on to Cyprus. So I'm going to be trying to get as many images from Italy as I can too, and collecting prayers and remaking prayers, and sort of it basing it on the mysteries of the rosary. So that's another thing that's cooking along. And, of course, I'm sure I will have music. I'm sure we'll do music for Mary, too. And I thought, where did this come from? You know, because Mary's never depicted with a drum, never. I've never found her depicted with a drum, but she's often surrounded by angels playing the tambourine. And sometimes she's painted on the traditional tambourines from South Italy. But I think that what's happening is that Mary wants her drum back. That's what I'm thinking.
Well, and I can't think of a better person to give it to her than you, Lenny.
I know. listen to this. All these rituals, women went to the grave during the funeral rites and played at graveside. We know the frame drum is used in the death and rebirth rituals. All the ancient rituals before the latest ritual based on death and rebirth, which was the Christ tradition of dying and being resurrected. We know that the frame drum provided the trance state for those experiences. We know that the frame drum women played at graveside. It was thought that the sound of the rhythms could help guide the deceased into the next life. We know that Inanna made her descent into the underworld and return by leaving her priestess Ninshabar playing the frame drum. So tell me about these Marys that went to Jesus' tomb.
They probably had a frame drum.
Exactly. That's what I've been thinking.
Yeah.
That's why they went there.
Well, and you know, and I know I'm sort of, you know, grabbing pieces of other people's theories here, but if you think about possibly Mary Magdalene, if she really did have any ISIS connections, and we know, you know, there were connections there to the frame drum, you know, the idea of her anointing Jesus with the, you know, the ointment in the alabaster jar, that was all ancient priestess stuff. So, you know, makes sense to me. I'm convinced.
Let me tell you, the frame drum came into Egypt from the Middle East. It came in with the Hyksos, and that's when the Egyptians rose up and dispelled the Hyksos from up in the Delta area, and then pushed on in and made military conquest in the Middle East. One of the things that was sent back to Egypt as part of the, what's it called when you conquer people and they have to send offerings? That's not quite the tribute. They have to send tribute. One of the things that was sent to the pharaohs were whole orchestras of women musicians.
Wow.
This is when
wow.
the frame drum came into Egypt, the round frame drum. That's when it came in. So Mary Magdalene didn't have to get her frame drum from ISIS. It was a part of her culture originally. And even today, many, many, many Arabic women and Iranian, Persian, and Turkish women still play the frame drum. They don't do it in public, but they do it in the homes, or they do it in their own spiritual gatherings. So Mary had access. There was probably frame drums in whatever household she was in.
Yeah, it was
so
already
that
in
is,
the culture.
It was in the culture.
Well,
the culture.
Now, Lane, we don't have a whole lot of time left, and I've promised, folks that listen to the show, if they've emailed in questions, I would ask you. So let me get to a couple of these questions before we run out of time.
Okay.
The first question comes from Lima Kathleen Graham. She's a dancing snake priestess. She says, Lane, I was just curious about your thoughts on the goddess Athena as possibly a dancing drumming priestess slash goddess. I made a dance of Athena and used a large drum with a labrys as a tom because from research I did on her, it said her shield was made from goat skin, which led me to believe that her shield might have actually been a drum. I believe that part of her sacred practice might have been taking the community into trance and calling them into action through her drum. Can you see her shield as a drum too?
I'd have to say no. I just spent a month in Greece, and I photographed Athena intensely at the Museum of the National Archaeological Museum there in Athens, a great one. And I studied the shield very carefully. It's a shield. It's not a drum. And Athena is in no text linked to the drum. I have never linked her to a drum. So
okay.
I would have to say that that's a shield.
Okay. All right. This next question comes from a scholar, Marguerite Rigoglioso. She says, question for Lane, to what degree do her musical creations regarding ancient Greece emerge from her own firsthand experience with this ancient material via trance, dreams, synchronicities, a feeling of being communicated with by the Greek deities and ancestral priestesses? Does she contend that she's had past lives related to ancient Greece? So I guess there are two questions there.
I don't know Marguerite in real life, but I know her through Cyber Space, and I love her work too. What I would say is I have no idea about, you know, past lives. I have no idea of what's going to happen to me when I die. I've been really focusing on death and rebirth, and went through having, a diagnosis last year of a malignant tumor and getting through that and going, I've just really been looking into death a lot, let's put it that way. And I have no idea. Zero. But I would say that I can tell you that the frame drum opens inspiration within myself. And the frame drum is very connected with the muses. The muses are often depicted playing the frame drum along with other instruments. But it is a way of opening this channel of inspiration within myself. Now, the frame drum, one of the very special things about it is that you hear the overtones of it very clearly. And when I'm playing it and I'm listening to the every stroke creates different sequences of overtones. And so the sequence of strokes creates your rhythm. So every rhythm sort of creates its own little melody of overtones. And when I'm listening, when I'm practicing and I'm playing, it sounds like you hear voices. I mean, anybody that practices a lot on the frame drum will hear these melodies, these voices. Sometimes they're so loud that I think somebody's actually spoken to me and I stop playing. But so I hear these songs in the drums. I hear these songs. And then I can start to hum them. And then sometimes I transpose the melodies onto a keyboard and work the melody out. And then what I do is bring in fabulous improvising musicians and create the drum tracks first and give them maybe a little bit of melody that I've created and let them improvise. And, you know, until I hear what matches something within me that I need to hear, that's what I keep looking for. And just to say how the music came together for this Invoking Aphrodite, I have a wonderful young musical partner in Brazil, Tadeo Mascarenhas, and he's young, and interestingly enough, his wife is named Melissa, and he has three beautiful little girls. And he was late for our session because the nanny didn't show up, and the girls are his responsibility till the nanny gets there. So I was waiting for him, and I started just playing my tambourine. I thought, I'm going to come up with a new rhythm. And I sat there, and I kept working until I got the sequence of sounds that made me feel in a particular way. And I love the rhythm that I came up with that day. And he got there, we went in and laid it down, and then I went in and did the words right after that, and he put keyboards down. Everything magically came together for that. I did another rhythmic part, then we brought in Vicki Richards, who's this amazing violinist. I guess I had her maybe do three solos until I found what I really wanted to hear. And that's what it is. I listen until it's something that matches something within me that I need to hear. It could be some ancient part of myself. I tell you, when I went in and spoke these words in the studio, it particularly the final oracle of Delphi, that was just chilling, because I tried to put myself in that woman's place after thousands of years of having powerful priestesses there at Delphi giving oracles. The temples were destroyed and the final oracle was given. And when I sat there and said that, I felt as if I was that ancient woman talking to my present self. It was very, very profound. And after I finished that, I came out and I wrote something. And what I wrote was the final oracle. For the last time, I became the Pythia. I purified myself. I drank from the sacred spring. I walked through the ruins alone. I sat upon the high tripod. I burned hallucinatory leaves, and I spoke to my future self.
Wow. You know, I led a tour to Greece, one of the first sacred tours I led, and one of the most powerful experiences I had as well was in Delphi. And, you know, we were anointing ourselves with the water that we believed was in a place where the Pythias used to bathe. And, you know, it's hard to really verbalize some of these things, you know, because you just sort of sound crazy. But, you know, we just felt connected to those ancient priestesses in a way that we didn't feel in other places. It was just this incredibly magical experience that, you know, it's like we were a continuation of this line, and it was profound. I don't know how else to say it, quite frankly, and I'm hearing the very same thing in what you're saying as well.
I guess that's it. I guess it is. Delphi is just, first of all, it's so extraordinarily beautiful. And it's such a small little town there. So in a way, so much of its beauty is still preserved. So I always try to go there whenever I go to Greece. It's very powerful there. And we also drove up above there. We rented a Jeep and went up. Well, we hired a Jeep to drive us up to this cave that's way up, and it had Neolithic artifacts. It's a huge cave, and the traditions were that the women went in that cave and did rituals and played the frame drum there. I actually found the cave sort of frightening. There were frightening sounds. Everybody else had left, and I was the last one in there alone, and probably whistling wind, but definitely some frightening sounds, and I left in a hurry. But it's very powerful, very powerful place.
Well, Lane, this has been delightful. You are a wonderful guest, and I'm sorry to say we're starting to run out of time here. Okay. So I guess I'd like to close by asking you, is there anything we haven't talked about that you think is important? You want to make sure you leave the idea with listeners, and I also want to make sure you mention your website so listeners can find out about your books, your new CDs, your trip, and everything else.
Well, that's the place for them to go, is to, www.laneredmond.com, LaneRedmond.com. If they can't remember that, they can do a search for When the Drummers Were Women. They'll end up on my site. And, you know, keeping up with the newest technology, well, I've already got a YouTube channel that I've posted many videos to, and we're moving into instructional videos. So there'll be there's already a lot up on my website and on all the different MySpace pages that I have. I have a MySpace page / Kippurginia, which is all about the Cypriot work and invoking Aphrodite. And then we have MySpace.com/ the Bee Priestess, which is about hymns from the hive. You can hear those pieces up there. So, yes, but my website would be the place to go. And also, get on the mailing list. Because that I'm going to be sending out practice materials, and that's where you'll know about everything. And people are following me on Facebook and Twitter. I use to you'll never know what I'm doing if you go to Twitter. You'll never hear about what I'm doing at the moment, but you'll see the videos that are influencing me, and listen to the music that's influencing me, and see the links that I think are really profound. That's what I'm using Twitter for, and Facebook to a certain extent. And Facebook, I'm networked throughout the Middle East with now. It's really amazing. I have so many musicians from Turkey, Iran, and Egypt on there, and Israel. It's very profound what's happening, and as we create this cyber network of frame drummers. And I just want to mention that one of my students, Miranda Rondau, she's created a women's frame drumming MySpace page and Facebook, and she's really reaching people. It's been amazing what she's created, the network around the world. So I'm a big fan of the cyber world and connecting that way, and I'll be putting up more and more instructional materials that way.
Wonderful. Well, and I'd like to give kudos to Miranda, too. She's an incredible drummer herself, and I'm sure, you know, you're probably her mentor, and she's doing you proud, Lane.
I'm so proud of her. I am so proud of her. She's just blossomed and turned into this amazing musician, singer, dancer, drummer, but also networker, priestess. Absolutely. As much as we can reclaim that. And I do want to say that, yes, I'm doing all this work, but next week I'm heading out to the Percussive Art Society's International Conference, and I'll be teaching a clinic on fusing Middle Eastern and Brazilian rhythms. So I'm really happy to keep my feet in all these worlds, on the ancient world and the woman, the world of women's sacred traditions and rituals, and also the academic percussive realm and the world that Remo's created with all these frame drums. It's been amazing. Remo has created these drums for us, enabling us all to be able to play.
Well,
so
you
I'm
know,
very thankful for that.
Well, we know it's all connected, you know, everything, you know, the past, the present, it, you know, we're just all layers of a big onion. That's how I sort of look at it.
Well, I've had a wonderful time in this interview. Thank you so much, Karen. Thank you so much for what you're doing and making this an archive and getting voices that may not be heard that much. When I see how little known Sappho is, and that people don't know about the Pythia priestess, which this position could arguably be said to be one of the most important positions in the ancient Mediterranean world. People don't know anything about it.
Right. Yeah, it is really sad. And I know some of the people who inspired me to do the radio show, and particularly this series, wrote me and said, you know, when I found your website, when I found your radio show, I felt like I was no longer alone. You know, I wasn't just wandering aimlessly in the desert anymore. You know, I found the foremothers. And, you know, it was people who said stuff like that that made me realize that we have to get these people who have been our mentors, and you know, and the new generation that's carrying the torch. I mean, you know, all of these people have to, you know, have their voice somewhere besides their books, you know, so that you know, people today, new women that are coming to the goddess, coming to, you know, these ideas, you know, have a way to, you know, hear their voice, know they're still there, understand their work, how it's evolved. You know, I don't know. I think it's important, and I'm really enjoying it myself.
Go ahead.
One final question for you, Lane. Any chance you're going to be teaching down in Southern California anytime soon?
Possibly January, I might come back, but definitely next fall. And I just wanted to say that it's really important to me to also reach into the younger world, the younger people coming up, and I do that through PASIC, and I'm also working with a young musician on music that's quite different. It's almost, I would have to say, it's very commercial, and it's based on these mysteries, on the ancient mysteries, and we're calling it the mysteries, and that's really important to me. I mean, yes, we're becoming the elders, but we need to reach the younger people. We really need to do that.
Absolutely, and there, I think there's nothing more important than bringing this, you know, out of the shadows and into the mainstream world so that it becomes the norm, and rather than what people are doing on the fringes.
Yeah, so thank you once again, and if people want to be sure they know what I'm coming out with, they should go to my website, and thanks so much, Karen.
No problem. That's laneredmond.com. Thank you, Lane, and good night, and have wonderful travels in the days ahead. Be safe.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, good night.
Well, we're going to take just a very short music break, and I'm going to let you listen to a little snippet from Jenna Green called Acceptance, and then I'm going to come back with some new and important announcements. Well, if you've been listening, this is Karen Tate. Hello again. Thank you for staying with us for these closing comments and announcements. I'm hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness. Whether the great she, as I like to call her, be deity to you, or archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just might save the world. One of the first announcements is if you're near Columbia, Missouri, please, a field trip is in order. Go to the University of Missouri. Check out an exhibit they have there called The Sacred Feminine Transcends History, Prehistory to Postmodern. It's an exhibit at the Museum of Art and Archaeology, again, at the University of Missouri in Columbia. You've probably heard me mention before, I'm now the Los Angeles Women's and Goddess Spirituality Examiner for Examiner.com. Check out my articles. You can find them by going to the Examiner.com website, or the homepage on my website has a link there. You can read my articles. The latest article is titled GOP in Humanity, Prophets Before People. Please keep tuned in during the weeks ahead during this fall series of Four Mothers and Wayshowers. Here are a few names to whet your appetite for the three-month series. Our next guest is Starhawk on November 4th, followed by Joan Marler, who's continuing the work of Maria Gimbutas on November 11th, then Barbara Walker on November 17th, and we finish out November with Genevieve Vaughn, who teaches about the gift economy, and she's the founder of the Sekhmet Temple outside Las Vegas. She'll be here on the show on November 8th. That's two nights in a row, November 17th and November 18th, rather than consecutive Wednesdays, because we're taking a week off for Thanksgiving. And we're returning in December with Pat Monahan on December 2nd, Charlene Spretnak on December 9th, Rhianne Eisler December 16th, Eleanor Gadden is our solstice guest on the 23rd of December. And we end the year with Isaac Bonowitz on the Wednesday before New Year's. I'd like to remind listeners that coming in January, it's not that far away, I have the privilege of being asked to teach the UU Feminist Theology Series, Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, at the Goddess Temple in Orange County. You might want to consider giving yourself this as a gift for the holidays. It's $25 a class. The sessions run from January through July every other week. It's $25 a class. And if you go to my website, KarenTate.com, go to the Goddess Store where we list classes, and you can find a full itinerary or curriculum of each of the 11 classes and the material that's covered in each. I'll be giving a talk on November 15th at the Sophia Temple, otherwise called Olindar, the home of Carla and Leigh McCloskey. That's in Malibu. The topic is the Sacred Feminine for a Sustainable Future. That's going to be some slides and discussion. And please, I invite you to go to my website if you haven't visited. There are free downloadable meditations there for you. I invite you to get to know me a little bit better. Check out my two books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations. I'm happy to say it's garnered some prestigious endorsements. And Walking an Ancient Path, my second book, won a place as a finalist in the USA National Best Books of 2008. Scholar David Hillman has remarked that the book is immensely pleasurable and an enlightening journey, but what's most important to me is, he said, it stands boldly against the patriarchal denigration of the divine feminine. Check out my events page, see if I'll be appearing in a town near you. And if you're interested in having me come to your town, let me know. I'm certainly open to that as well. Well, listeners, as we come to a close tonight, if you like what you've been hearing on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, please tell your friends. Tune in. Please add us as one of your favorites on Blog Talk. Even consider signing up as a listener and have reminders of upcoming shows directly to your email box, because it's all free. Well, as I say good night, I'd like to leave you with some music. And tonight, I think we're going to go with something a little bit different. Desert Horse by Dragon Ritual Drummers. So I hope you enjoy it. And please come back next week, and when we have Starhawk on the show. Good night, and thanks for tuning in.